Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Technology and design have changed pretty much everything we do and touch over the past few years, except for how we shower. That is largely the same, but that is about to change for you because there's a company called GrowUp, spelled G-R-O-H-E, that is the maker of innovative faucet and showering products. They are renowned for their worldwide German engineering, their cosmopolitan style, and their intuitive performance and sustainability. GrowUp products feel like they were designed just for you. Turn up your showering experience with GrowUp Smart Control, the latest in shower customization technology. Smart Control lets you manage up to 3 bath and shower functions with one seamless control. You can declutter your shower wall and elevate your shower experience at the same time. They are fully personalized. It's literally like just this beautiful technology that you stick on your wall that actually changes your shower experience. It's got temperature and volume controls with the smart control. It looks gorgeous. It really changes the way you shower. Learn more about GrowUp Smart Control at growa.us/hive. That's growa.us/hive. Once again, growa.us/hive. Welcome to Inside the Hive. I'm your host, Nick Bilton. We have a special treat this week. This podcast was actually recorded in front of a live audience, real human beings. I actually interviewed Dara Khosrowshahi, who is the CEO of Uber, who took the reins over from Travis Kalanick after he was tossed out of the company for a lot of bad stuff that happened while he was there. And we recorded this conversation in front of an audience at the Vanity Fair New Establishment Summit. We got to a lot of different stuff, including what it's like to take over from a CEO who has kind of left the company in a bad place, how he plans to fix the culture of Uber, and what it's going to be like when automation takes a lot of jobs away from people who are currently driving for Uber. Stick around after the show because John Kelly and I are going to talk to each other about some of the things we saw at the conference, including a conversation that we both had with Michael Avenatti, who is Stormy Daniels' lawyer, and about the 2020 election. We're going to actually be posting a few different clips from the conference this week, so keep an eye out in your podcast app and you will see some pop up, some really amazing conversations with some really brilliant people. So without further ado, let's go talk to Dara.
That was actually an internal video that we prepared for our employees when we reframed the mission of the company.
Is it going to be out in public now too? Or
it wasn't designed for public. This is the first time we've shown it to the public, but it was really this idea for us as a company that we are about movement and opportunity and how the two are very much interlinked. There's a way to frame Uber in that we are essentially a market for labor. And the labor happens to be driving. And then obviously we're very much in the transportation business. And ultimately for us, movement represents freedom. Movement represents the opportunity to go chase something that you want. And we wanted to link the two together as part of the mission going forward.
So how much of this is a fancy ad campaign, and how much of it has the company actually changed and the culture changed?
The culture change is still going on, right? Like you don't set a culture out there and all of a sudden magically happens. I think that one of the remarkable things that I saw when I came to Uber was that there was this very different view of Uber from the outside than the inside. When I met the engineers, the product people, et cetera, they really believed in this idea of democratizing movement and transportation to the world, fundamentally making a world a better place as a result of the services that we offer. But I think the how, to some extent, How we grew, maybe we grew a little too fast, et cetera, was what needed to be changed. So I think we're on a journey as a company. We do believe that we can be a force for good. I think that we've demonstrated that externally in how we approach regulators, how we approach cities. We've really taken some big steps on the safety front. So we are slowly but surely changing our actions, but deeply rooted in what we're doing is this idea of democratizing movement and opportunity for everybody. But the cultural change continues. You know, you never stop working on culture at a company. And for us, this is a beginning of a journey for us.
So you said you've done some stuff on the safety side. There's a story in Toronto last month of an Uber driver who had just moved to the city. He'd been there for about a few days and dropped his phone, pulled into traffic, was hit, and the passenger was killed. And one of the big complaints from people in Toronto, and there was protests, and I'm sure you know all about this, was that if you're a taxi driver, you have to go through a 17-day safety program. If you're an Uber driver, you just download an app and so on. Do you think that when you kind of look at these, and look, I understand that these things are far and few between, but do you think that there is more that you can do with safety?
Absolutely. So we put safety as the top priority for the company, and we have introduced safety features like a 911 button, essentially integration with 911. So if something does happen to you, you can instantly connect with 911. They know what car you're driving, they know where you are, et cetera. We've introduced features, for example, your loved one can track where you are so that she or he can know where did you start, did you end, et cetera.
Not good for people in an affair.
Well, you know, be careful about who you share your trips with. And then we have now new technologies where we are looking at sensing how the trip is going. So for example, if a trip from beginning to end should take 15 minutes and there's a 20-minute stop in the middle, we are now going to interact with you and reach out to you proactively and say, Nick, is everything okay? You know, did you need a bathroom break? What's going on here? So we're actually, I think the ability for us to build technology to make the Uber platform fundamentally safer is something that we have been working in earnest as a top priority for a year. And I think it can go on and on and on from here. Fundamentally, we believe that we as a platform are making moving from place to place safer. Drunk driving, for example, is something that hopefully will be of the past. And we're going to back it up. We've actually, this next year, we're going to issue essentially a safety scorecard. And that's going to be scary for us.
What do you mean a safety scorecard?
Essentially,
for drivers?
Safety
like this
scorecard
guy might kill you and this one won't?
No, or? You can never predict that. Yeah, you know. it's looking overall
at
our platform. Yeah, it's looking overall at our platform and essentially putting the safety statistics out there. How many accidents were there? How many serious issues were there? And we want that to be a marker for the transportation industry. I think that data in general has been something that companies and governments have held too closely. And for example, we are now sharing our traffic data with cities to help them design street patterns, curbside pickup, drop-off, traffic patterns, lights, et cetera, so that we are actually sharing the data out with the cities to improve how cities move. And we believe from a safety standpoint, we should be sharing that data with consumers, cities, so that you, as a consumer, know what's the safest mode of transportation one way or the other. And it's going to force us then to keep investing in safety and turning it up a notch and continue to innovate around safety as well.
So last night I was with your wife. You were there too, don't worry. and I asked her what questions she would ask you on stage.
Uh-oh.
And she said, what were you most scared of when you took this job?
God, what was I most scared of?
Travis coming into your room at night killing you?
No.
Sorry.
That was a nice one. Thank you. Travis was actually very supportive through the process. And he's been a supportive board member. I think what I was most scared of is this.
The
public profile of the job. I had ran Expedia for 13, 14 years, partnered up with Barry Diller, who was a terrific partner. And we had investors, et cetera, but I had a chairperson with whom I was aligned. We went out and we built a company together without the kind of public glare that we have now on Uber. And it was something that is, you know, it's exciting, but at the same time, you read about it and you can imagine what it's like, but until you are in the seat, you really don't know how it feels.
So a couple of years ago, you could have been in the audience, and no offense, but no one would have known who
no
you
offense
were.
Taken, yeah.
And now if you type in D-A-R in Google, it auto-completes your name, which I'm sure pisses off a lot of people.
I had no idea.
With
yeah.
Dart. And then there's YouTube videos that explain how to say your last name with thousands and thousands of views.
Did you watch one?
I watched one because I still don't know how to do it. But don't test me, please. What was it like going from like being, I mean, you know, a lot of people, a lot of well-known CEOs, they kind of get this gradual thing. You parachuted in. What was that like?
I'm still honestly getting comfortable with it. My wife, Sydney, is kind of pissed off at me because when we go out to dinner, I get recognized every once in a while.
Do people complain about their Uber to you a lot?
You know, most of them are pretty positive, and then there are a lot of ideas that come out. We actually, we have some good ideas out there.
Yeah.
We're working on them. But Sid and I like to, for example, bike around San Francisco with the kids. And the other day we were biking around, a guy shouts at me from the car, "Couldn't afford a Uber?" And, you know, he thought like he was hilarious, but I was
and
like
Travis, come on, leave
here.
Me alone. all right, so let's talk about the board for a second. So I've covered some pretty crazy boards in my time. All boards are crazy, and most boards are crazy. Look, Apple back in the day was mayhem. Twitter, which I wrote a book about, is without question the most insane. Thank you very much. Nice plug there. Twitter was so crazy that one of the board members ended up leaving his wife to go and getting together with Jack Dorsey's ex-girlfriend. I mean, it's like just total nuts stuff. However, the Uber board actually takes the cake. You had board members suing each other, you had people leaking everything to the
press.
We've
had no affairs.
You've had no affairs as that you know of. Have you... There's a theme here going on here. Have you been able to tame the board? And if so, how?
I don't know if taming the board is the right term. I think the board is in a much, much better place. Where we came from last year was not necessarily a board, but an investor group that was struggling for control of the company. And there were investors, and there was some of the founders who were fundamentally misaligned in the direction of the company, and that translated up to the board and how it operated. And we solved that by essentially blowing up control so that there is no one who can control the company. And once the ability to control the company disappeared, then the board got down to business of building. And at this point now, we brought in a chairman, Ron Sugar, who's also on the Apple board, Chevron. He's run a company, Northrop Grumman, for many, many years. He understands what it's like to sit in the CEO board. He also understands what the role of a board is. And having him there is great because I've got so much to do on the business side that having a partner at the board, and I had one with Barry that was incredible. I think hopefully Ron and I can build that partnership as well. Now the board is focused on building the company, on preparing the company and thinking about growth, not just 1 year out, but 5 years out, thinking about our IPO, which we're preparing for next year. And at this point, I think that the board is, you know, we're kind of coming together as a team. And right now, my engagement with the board is much, much more positive. So I think those days are behind us.
How often
I think there are good days ahead of us.
How often do you interact with Travis?
I interact with them at board meetings, and then offline we talk every once in a while. And Travis has incredible knowledge and background on the company. I think he wants to help the company. And he's also, you know, doing his own thing. You know, he is an entrepreneur at heart. And he's not a person who's gonna, you know, sit around relaxing. So he is off to building another business, and I think he's a terrific builder. And I think he provides me advice when I need it, and he's been very respectful of that.
Do you worry that he's post-IPO going to try to take his job back? And is it a job that you want to keep for an indefinite period of time?
I don't worry about that.
You
listen,
don't?
I want to be my job. No. What's going on with Travis and you? I want to be in my job. I want to be in my job as I deserve that job.
Yeah.
The minute I'm not doing my job, it is in my interest to be out of that role. I'm not focused. I'm focused on building with a company. I'm focused on building a team. I'm focused on creating a company that we can be as a team proud of. And you know, the job will take care of itself.
One of the things is Jeff Bezos was being interviewed this week, and he was talking about how as a company, you know, a lot of companies, they find themselves in a situation where they can only grow in a certain direction and space. You know, Lionsgate, for example, can only really make movies and TV shows. They're not going to start a driverless car company. Amazon can go anywhere. That's what Bezos said. And it seems that that is the case with Uber, too. Where are some of the things that you imagine that the company will go, either pre-IPO, post-IPO, that are not just scooters or food, but something that you know, you haven't really spoken about before?
Well, these scooters and food can be big, right? We suffer from having too much opportunity right now as a company, and we've got to pick our spots, and then where we pick our spots go in very, very heavy. The transportation industry, this is a $6 trillion global business. We're 1% of this business in terms of how people and things move around cities. And you know, we have our main ride-sharing business. With Eats, we're getting into the business of moving food around, and I think that this product of delivering great quality food to you at the home in 30 minutes or less is magical, and it's going to actually move into grocery in a way that's fundamental, and a lot more people are going to be eating at home. So I think Eats can be an opportunity.
So there's a world where you do Uber grocery shopping?
Right now, we are busy with Eats, but you can absolutely see grocery as being an adjacency. But right now, it's all in on Eats, because I think Eats can be as big as the rides business. But when we think about Uber right now, we're thinking about it as much more as a platform. Really, you know, I've talked about our building the Amazon of transportation, and that means our being an orchestration layer, so that any way that you want to get a thing or you want to get yourself from one place in the city to the other, we have all of the choices available. It is beautifully orchestrated so that you've got real-time information on how to get from point A to point B. You can pay for it automatically, and you can do it all on the Uber app. And movement is something that you engage in every single day, 3 to 5 times a day. Eating is something that you do 3 times a day. So these are habits that go very, very deep, and someone needs to be the orchestration layer for people moving around in cities, and I think that can be us. And I think it's an enormous opportunity. It will be on the ground, it'll be with people, it'll be autonomous, it'll be in the air, and eventually I think we have an opportunity getting into freight business as well, moving things. So there's a lot that we're doing, and the real challenge for us is where do we focus and where do we partner?
So once you get all your data and it's all working to move people around and then food around, can you essentially just take that data and say, okay, we're going to put it on freight and understand how that system works and apply it that way? Or
we are building a freight automated brokerage system, essentially, matching shippers and trucks, taking the middleman out, essentially giving more money either to the shippers or the truckers as well. Right now, it is a process that requires tons and tons of people making phone calls, taking big margins, and we essentially want to use automation to give the margin back to the truck driver or the shipper, one way or the other. And I think the intelligence, that matching intelligence, is the same exact matching intelligence that we use to match you with a car or to match you with food.
But you just said the word automation and giving it back to the trucker and the driver. Isn't automation going to take away those jobs? And this is a two-part question, actually. Isn't it going to take away those jobs? And A, and B, you put all your automation on hold recently, so how does this all kind of
come together? We haven't put it on hold. We put the testing in the streets on hold until we know that our testing can be absolutely safe, and we expect to be on the road before the end of the year. But I've got to know, the team has to know, that it is as safe as humanly possible. I think that the drama around automation that the press loves to talk about is that machines are going to replace people, and I think that's totally wrong.
Really?
I think that the superior entity is machines and people together. You see it in auto manufacturers. you know, autos actually, auto manufacturing is becoming more and more automated, but the manufacturers that have gone all the way to automation actually have largely failed, and the ones who are augmenting people and machines together have improved, and actually it's resulted in more jobs, but it's resulted in the number of parts, for example, in a car going from an average of 3,000 parts to 40,000 parts. So automation, people and machines together, is the superior entity. And for example, as it relates to us, I think that for the next 10 years, you know, we're less than 1% of miles driven on the road. As we build automation and self-driving cars, which will be in the road when they're fundamentally safer than human drivers, the cost per mile of our network is going to come down, which is going to increase the demand going into the network. And I think we will be 20 to 30% of miles driven on the road. And even in a circumstance where we're 20% of miles driven on the road, we're 20 times bigger, even if humans drive 20% of the miles. And you want humans to work on the complex value-added tasks, even if they drive 20% of the miles, that's four times the number of driver partners than we have today. So automation builds businesses, builds new services, and people and machines are the superior thing.
I disagree with you, but I'm going to leave it at that.
Time will tell.
Time will tell. You know, I mean, if you look back in history, the most tumultuous time in history from a crime standpoint was actually during the Industrial Revolution, because, and this happened over 120 years, there was so much job loss so quickly that people turned to crime, and we now have Donald Trump as president. And
Industrial Revolution and Donald Trump, interesting.
I just had to drop it somehow. No, but that was 120 years. This is going to take place in 10, 15, and it just feels like it's something that we should be talking about a little bit more, rather than, you know.
Well, I think we're talking about it. I do believe that while there may be displacement in certain geographies, and we as a society have to be aware of that displacement, and we have to be there to take care of the people who are displaced and retrain them. Over what you've seen in the past 20 years is automation coming into the manufacturing sector, et cetera. And the fact is that actually labor and employment has been improving, not the other way around. Now, automation does create value and move some value over to asset owners. And I think the bigger issue that we have in our society is that the asset owners have enormous advantages over laborers. And I think one of the great things about Uber is that it is taking the ability to move, the ability to get to places away from the people who can own cars, and making it available to everybody, regardless of whether you live in the center of the city. We are making transportation available to people who live in the outskirts, to people who can't afford a car, and essentially that transportation as a service is going to move value from asset owners to laborers or people who can't afford to own assets, and I think that's a force for good.
We have one last question, the question is, I get in Ubers all the time, and I'm sure you do too, and you sit there with the driver and you say, hey, you know, where are you from, what do you do, and I don't know, six times, seven times out of ten, it's someone who's their second job. They're a teacher, they're a janitor, they're a bus driver, and they're working two, three jobs, and I wonder if, and there's also on the other end of that, there was a story in the New York Times last week about Uber drivers and taxi drivers who have been committing suicide because they can't pay their bills. The IPO is going to make a lot of people into billionaires. Your job is to make Uber into a better company. Have you ever thought about possibly, you know, giving back to the drivers more, or becoming a B corporation or something that can, like Patagonia, that can let the wealth be shared a little bit more?
I think that we haven't thought about being a B corporation, honestly, but we have thought about some kind of equity vehicle for our driver partners. I think the most important factor is our driver partner earnings. You know, how can we make sure that their earnings are predictable? How can we make sure that their earnings are stable? Can we actually provide our driver partners with benefits? So for example, in Europe, we've introduced benefits that are available to all of our driver partners, health benefits, maternity leave, paternity leave, et cetera. So I think, listen, our driver partners are engaging with a platform because it provides them flexibility and it provides them opportunity to earn. I would love to, over a period of time, get them coverage safety and over a period of time improve their opportunity to earn, I don't think that an equity vehicle, you know, that's a temporal thing, right? It's like we've got to solve the structural issues there. And I think it gets down to earnings, healthcare, et cetera. And I think those are the areas that we've been working on with some success in Europe. And I think we have our work cut out for us here.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
So one of the most used apps on my phone is not a social network. It is not a messaging app. It is not the web browser. It is actually the app Audible. I use it obsessively. I'm always listening to audiobooks on Audible because it is the best place to get audiobooks. And if you remember, there are tons of things that you get for free. There's exclusive audio fitness programs. You also get your audiobooks that you can listen to. They have Audible Originals, which are custom content that they're creating just for members. I'm listening to several different books on Audible right now. I like to switch between depending on my mood for that day. I'm currently listening to Red Sparrow, which is an amazing novel about the CIA and Russia and so on. I just finished listening to Stephen King's 11/22/63, which was mind-blowing. I sometimes listen to nonfiction books too. I listened to The Big Picture recently, which is Sean Carroll's book. He was a guest on the show once. My book, American Kingpin, is available on there. It's a great listen. Every month, Audible members get one credit for a book that they want to listen to. Plus, they get two Audible originals from a changing selection that you can't get anywhere else. Plus, your book's yours to keep. If you want to go back and listen again, you can, even if you cancel your membership. And if you don't like an audiobook, you just get to exchange it. What Audible is doing today for us, for all of you wonderful listeners, is they are going to give us a 30-day trial, and your first audiobook is free. All you need to do is go to audible.com/hive or text the code HIVE, you all know how to spell that, H-I-V-E, to the number 500-500, and you can get started. Once again, go to audible.com/hive, that's H-I-V-E, or text H-I-V-E to 500-500, and you will be able to get your first 30-day trial and your first free audiobook. It is everything you need right now to escape the chaotic world that we live in today. Welcome back, John Kelly. That was an interesting conversation, to say the least, with Dara. Thoughts, comments, observations?
You've been thinking about adultery a lot, Nick. I don't know, maybe you're reading Anna Karenina again.
He didn't. I don't think he was a big fan of my Travis questions, but that's the question everyone wants to know. You know, they look at the theme in Silicon Valley of the founder getting kicked out and coming back triumphantly to seal revenge. Jobs did it. Dorsey did it. You know, and Travis clearly wants to do it too. So if I'm not going to ask that question. It's.
You know, you're obviously totally within your right to ask that question, but I think the big difference between the Apple and Twitter paradigm here is that I'm not sure Dara Khosrowshahi would mind if Travis came back into the fold 4 years from now, because, and I think we'll be talking about this a little bit, that's going to, you know, there'll be a moment in the 5 to 10 year timeline horizon when Uber goes from dealing with its, you know, sort of startup issues and operational issues and organizational problems and culture issues to dealing with major complexities around automation and eliminating a large part of its human workforce and those may be problems that Dara doesn't want to be around for.
Yeah, and I think that that was my biggest frustration with the interview was that he, I don't think was honest necessarily about what really is going to happen with automation. Maybe he truly believes that it won't destroy society, but I think that automation, artificial intelligence, machine learning, it's not analogous to the Industrial Revolution, where there were machines that assisted people. It's not analogous to it being a tool like a paintbrush or a camera. It is going to be analogous to human beings or one specific part of a human being. And I think that is, if we're not addressing that now, and if companies like Uber are not addressing that now, it's the same thing as companies like Facebook not addressing fake news, or Twitter not addressing bots, Russian bots, and down the line, whether it's 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15, the repercussions are going to be disastrous.
Yeah, so Silicon Valley CEOs tend to get around this sort of line of inquiry by, and it may be authentic to some degree, by just explaining how they see the world. You know, these guys have made a fortune by basically trend spotting 10 years out further than most other, you know, executives and entrepreneurs and innovators can. And I think that to some extent, they think that they're really just moving with tectonic trends, and they believe things will sort themselves out. You know, as we know, the Industrial Revolution was extremely painful to most people.
Yep.
And the secondary Industrial Revolution, the one that occurred later when these tasks were sort of institutionalized, was also a period that created a lot of winners and a lot of losers too. These are hard things to deal with.
Yeah, well, but that's why these people are paid billions of dollars to deal with them. That's what the money's for. And the other last thing on this comment before we move on to you know who is that there's some fascinating papers and books out there about during the Industrial Revolution, which for back then in society happened at a very speedy pace. It was 120 years it took place for the entire Industrial Revolution to take place. It was the largest rise in crime in history. And the reason for that was that people didn't have jobs and they still wanted to support their families and feed themselves. And so, you know, they stole bread because they couldn't afford to buy it. And a lot of other things happened along the way. And I think, unless we're actually having real conversations with the people who are making these decisions and building these things about what could and will happen, then I just think it's not going to be pretty. So,
no, I don't think anyone thinks it's going to be pretty. It'll create a very, very small class of super winners and a much larger class of losers.
Of super losers. Hopefully I won't be a super loser, but there's a pretty good chance I will be.
It's possible.
Speaking of super losers, so one of the things I thought was most interesting about the entire Vanity Fair Summit conference that you and I have just been at for the past few days was at the very end when me and you and Emily Jane Fox sat down in the green room with Michael Avenatti, and it was the first time I've actually spent time with him, Stormy Daniels' lawyer, and talking about kind of, 2020 and who's going to run, who can win and whatnot. And the thing that I found so interesting was Avenatti didn't say he was running. It seems pretty apparent that he probably will at some point, but for president, but that he said that the same thing that Steve Bannon recently said on Bill Maher, that that he is the one person that can take on Trump. And I didn't get it at first. And then it kind of hit me after during his session with Emily Jane Fox that, Trump can wipe the floor with a goody two shoe. But with Avenatti, what is he going to say? What's Trump going to say that when Avenatti says, hey, look, I represent the woman that you slept with and paid off. Trump can't respond to that. And I think that it was just really kind of a telling moment to hear Avenatti's viewpoint on that. And I'm just curious if you think, A, he will run, and B, if he could actually put a dent into Trump land.
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up that people who want to watch this interview can check it out on The Hive. And I think we're going to air some audio from it on a future episode of this podcast. But I think that, I like Michael. I mean, it's hard not to. I've interviewed him a bunch of times before. And at the end of the day, he can be a pretty genuine person. And I think he was genuine. He was as candid with us offstage as he was on stage in that he said, look, I'm not a politician. I don't even really know where I stand on the issues, so to speak. I don't have a portfolio of policies. But I think that I've kind of just, I'm the kryptonite. I've been given this special, highly media-trained efficacy that allows me to get under Trump's skin in a way that Hillary Clinton couldn't, that Ted Cruz couldn't, that Marco Rubio couldn't, that Jeb Bush couldn't, that it seems unlikely that Cory Booker or Kamala Harris or maybe Joe Biden, to some extent, that's a wild card, could. So his strategy, his topic A is that he thinks he's electable, and he half apologizes for it. You know, he sort of recognizes, look, I didn't pick this. I was born with it. It's almost like hearing a pitcher talk about just having the gift of a 102 mile an hour fastball. But to answer your question, I think that he will realize at some point that skill is going to be best deployed both for him and for the election and for the Democratic Party on the sidelines rather than in the arena, so to speak.
I see. I mean, I think he could be a very effective attack dog in the beginning. If there's 27 people on stage and Trump is attacking Kamala Harris, or who I don't think can win either in this climate, especially because, you know, the majority of people are not looking necessarily for the most successful person to run, as Avenatti said on stage, you know, Hillary Rodham Clinton was probably the most suited person to ever run for president in the history of the United States. And I think that she wasn't elected because for a variety of reasons. And I think that what's interesting is you are going to need to have someone who is not the typical person who you would expect to run for president or even win in the same way Trump wasn't in 2016. And I think, you know, there's a world in which Avenatti gets to be the attack dog, gets to kind of to wound Trump a little bit, if that's humanly possible. And then maybe someone else comes in for the win.
But don't forget, though, that the first step of any process, not to be a Debbie Downer here, but the first step of the process will be to fend off the other 15 or 16 Democrats on the stage. And while I think it is a compelling talking point to an electorate to say, look, I'm the one who can beat Trump, so let's just cut the bullshit and get right there, I think that if he does that, he'll be fighting a 15-to-1 battle, you know, where other respectable candidates who have a lot of experience in politics will say, okay, but to say that is to really disrespect the interests of the 50 million voters who turned out and voted for the Democrats in the last election, or the however many are registered as Democrats, and that's quite cheap. So it's a long road, and the primaries are usually vicious. You know, just remember how vicious the Republican primary was. Avenatti? To get through that, it requires a different set of skills than the one that he very ably demonstrates when he's talking about the president.
Yeah, I completely agree.
You are listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
I'd like to tell you a little story. There was once an attorney in New York City named Linda who transformed her hobby of locating hard-to-find items into a thriving luxury consignment company called Linda's Stuff. What was once a passion project is now a 100-person company in a 93,000-square-foot facility. As a company specializing in high-end, previously owned goods, reputation is everything. Integrity and trust are a critical part of how the company operates. From day one, Linda has counted on PayPal to help give her customers confidence and protect her business from fraud, even when selling internationally, which can be a tad dicey, as you all know. She's counted on PayPal every single step of the way with her business. When it comes to growing your business, PayPal is your payments partner for today and for tomorrow. Visit paypal.com/growth to set up your business account today. You can sign up for free, paypal.com/growth. Look, we're 30 days away from the midterms, which will tell everything, and then it's going to be the day after. It's going to be kind of guessing who's running and people announcing, and there'll be lots of time for discussion about it. One person who I hope is not running, for God's sake, is douchebag Kanye West, who was in the White House this week, mm-hmm. and a reporter actually said to Trump, "Is Kanye West a future presidential candidate?" And Trump said he could be, but he'd have to run in 2024. And Kanye got very excited, which means that Kanye, you know, probably wants more and more attention.
Look out, Mike Pence! I think Kanye is a potential ticket mate.
I can only hope so. I'm sure Mother would be very happy
about
that.
Mother will be happy. Mother will be so sad, yeah.
Well, I think that we should probably wrap things up. Anything else you want to talk about before we let our listeners go?
You know, my one observation coming back from the VF New Establishment Summit, I'm just curious to get your take on this, is...
Yep.
You know, this was a year that it really did seem like everyone's kind of in competition with one another, no matter what business you're in, because we're kind of evolving from an age of purely paid media to one where everyone is figuring out their subscription game. John Stankey on stage broke the news to Andrew Sorkin that AT&T, not surprisingly, is coming up with a bundle that's built around HBO as its nucleus. And he was asked by Andrew, how many subscription packages do you think the normal family will pay for? The assumption being that people will stop subscribing to like Xfinity or Optimo or Time Warner and start just picking the bundles that they like. And Stankey said, I don't think it's more than 10. I think it's more than 2. So he's got quite a bit of latitude there. How do you see this next phase playing out, Nick? And do you think that that the competition will extend not just between Disney Flix, which is the new Disney service, and whatever AT&T is doing, and Netflix, but also to like the New York Times, the Washington Post, to some extent Vanity Fair, which has its own subscription metering business now. Do you think that it's going to be a flattened playing field?
A flattened playing field? I mean, I think that my personal belief is one from the consumer standpoint, which is that, you know, I remember it was actually the first big article. First, I think it was the first article I ever wrote for the New York Times in 2009 was about me cutting my cable, it was essentially like a how-to guide for how to get rid of your cable bill and how to watch things over the top. This is pre Hulu, set top, all that stuff. It's like, and it was that article sat on the most emailed list for a couple of months at the top of it. And the reason was because so many people were so fed up with their cable bill, and they were so fed up with the fact that they had to pay $125 a month when they watched like two channels, and that there were all these stupid hidden costs that were on their bill every month, and you couldn't get anyone to fix your cable, blah, 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 blah. And I think that that over the top is not just about a want and a need for the things that the shows that you want to watch. It's about the fact that the previous model, quite frankly, excuse my language, fucking sucked.
Yeah. And everyone hates it. You look at the top 10 most disliked companies in America. It's, you know, a lot of cable companies are up there.
Yeah, and rightly so. And I think that what happened is you had everyone start to cut their cable, and then you had, you know, Netflix, of course, use that to its advantage. And now you have everyone that's saying, oh, well, if we charge $10 a month, we can get, we can get our revenues back up, and so on and so forth. The problem is that they're all going to do that, and you're going to end up with essentially the same thing as cable, but with you're just paying your $123 a month to 12 different places. And I think what happens in that situation is eventually, of course, you know, it won't be $10 a month at AT&T or Disney or wherever. It'll be 11 and then 12, and then there'll be a tax that shows up that's not really a tax. And I think that, and then consumers will figure out a way to cut the next thing and to find a way around that. And I think that that these companies, I do believe this. I believe companies like AT&T and Verizon, they are greedy, greedy, greedy companies. And I think that if they continue to act in a greedy, greedy way and charge too much, that then there'll be some technology that comes along to usurp them in the same way, and rightly so. And so I don't believe that we will be a households where you pay 12 different places $10 or whatever it is. I think that there's going to be a limit to it. And, and there's a world, I do believe, you know, I know people that will sign up for Hulu for a month just to watch, because Hulu won't let you watch one of their, you know, favorite shows like Handmaid's Tale or whatever on iTunes yet or whatever. So they sign up for a month, they watch the show, and then they they disconnect their service. And it's not just about great content. It's about actually being fair to the consumer, especially in the age we live in today. And so I do think that that's a future that that we'll see happen.
And just to prove that I wasn't making that up, I'm on a Yahoo Finance story from a year ago. The most hated companies in America, and Comcast is number one. Then Bank of America, and then if you keep going down the list, there's Facebook. Dish is on there, and then Charter Communications is number 12. So it's real. People don't like paying $150 a month for what you're talking about. What interests me actually, I came out of this all quite optimistic that it seems like people pay between 10 and 15 bucks a month for HBO and for Netflix, something like that. That's about what they pay for the Washington Post app, right? I mean, it's interesting how the value proposition in this marketplace works out. That there's some sort of recognition that that qualitative journalism, even if it's not as seductive and visual and often multimedia, is as valuable as certain other sight, sound, and motion content libraries.
It's really fascinating, and I just wonder if how this all nets out. I mean, I think that you'll definitely, the one thing that will come true is that you'll have more quality content for more money and more and less quality content with less money or free or advertising based. I mean, Facebook is a perfect example of that. It's all ad based, and most of the stuff you see is just total crap. And yet, you know, you pay for the New York Times, the Washington Post, Vanity Fair, and you see much higher quality content. And the same is true for Netflix. And I think that, you know, YouTube, the free videos that all these kids make are free and they're not that great. And I think the question is, do we find a balance somewhere in the middle where we're paying $50 a month for the things that the media we want to consume? Or, you know, does it net out differently and we have to pay more or less or whatever? The one last thing I do want to point out, actually, that I forgot about that from the conference that I thought was really interesting was that from, you know, I've been to several of these conferences now, I think to all of them. And what's so interesting is when I think back to like last year and the year before and the year before that, the people who didn't come this year and why, it's fascinating. So 2 years ago, one of the headliners of the Vanity Fair conference was Elizabeth Holmes, mm-hmm. who 2 days later...
3 years ago, yeah, right.
John Carreyrou came out and with his first article in the Wall Street Journal, and today Elizabeth Holmes is still under investigation from the FBI, and the company has shut down, and God knows what she's doing, and she settled with the SEC, and everyone kind of disbanded, and so on, and then also, you know, last year Les Moonves was up on stage, and he is now gone. And there's a lot of people that when I think back over the years who I saw at this conference and other conferences, not just this one, who have been Me Too'd. And it's so fascinating to see how quickly that happened and how effective it was. Rightly so. And it'd be like showing up to a bar every day and then all of a sudden a few regulars stop showing up. And it turns out that they were bad people doing bad things. I thought that was fascinating.
You're right. To equally prove your point, a year ago, Michael Avenatti was literally unknown. And now he's arguably the most, one of the 15 most recognizable people in America.
Yeah, completely. Yep. And I think that, you know, back to closing it up with that, back to the beginning, like, I actually don't think that whoever has the opportunity and possibility of beating Trump in 2020 from the Democratic side, I don't think we know who that person is yet, because I think that it's going to take someone who is come out of nowhere. I mean, look, Beto O'Rourke, a year ago, no one knew who he was, mm-hmm. Outside of a small little district in Texas. And today everyone knows who he is. And I think that that is what is going to be needed, to defeat Mr. Orange.
Well, we'll see.
And Kanye West. We'll see.
God love him.
John, it's been fabulous.
Nick, it's been great. It's been super.
I hope you get some sleep. Thanks to my guest today, Dara Khosrowshahi, and of course, John Kelly, who took a red eye last night and was exhausted for this discussion. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a really sweet, lovely, warm, glowing review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work, to my editors of Vanity Fair, and thanks most of all, and of course, to our fantastic, unbelievable, incredible sponsors, Groa, Audible, and PayPal. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I will see you all next week.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new three-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterized the early years of Black Twitter to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.